Hi there, Jerry. Fancy seeing you here. I was just wandering around the podcast space that we have, the metaphysical space that represents audio goodness that we purvey. And I happen to bump into you here at this metaphysical water cooler, which is a different way to introduce an episode, but we're going with it, Jerry. And Jerry, I've got a question for you. My question, Jerry, is if you happen to be in a metaphysical space and you were a utility or a tool or a something found in a kitchen, and your destiny was to go to war with every other tool or utility or item in a kitchen, what would you be in order to ensure conquest? What kitchen item would you be so that you could defeat all the other ones?
Wow. I'd be the sink.
Would you be a sink with a garburator? Is that what you're just going to garburate all your enemies?
Nope. I'm just going to drown them. I'm going to open it up, let it go. Hey, 2 hours and I'm the only one that matters. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. All right. I see it.
That may be the most, we'll just go with the interesting question I've ever been asked in my life. I've never been kind of put into that space of what if you had to take over the world and be something in the kitchen.
I know. I would love to take credit. I'd love to take credit for that, Jerry, but I can't. It came from our guest today. I'm not even answering our water cooler virtual space question introduction. I'm just moving right on to introduce our guest. That's how excited I am, Jerry. I put you on the spot and now we're moving on. Thank you. I'm very proud to introduce to the Diesel and Clooney podcast a man that I think we're going to have a phenomenal time chatting with, a man whose name I absolutely love because it's got a great ring to it and it's easy to remember. Jerry, may I present to you, Joe George.
Joe George, it's great to have you. I have so many questions. Let's talk. Yeah.
Pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having me.
Joe, first of all, because you inspired that introduction. And as if we told both our listeners on previous episodes, normally half of our recording is just me trying to come up with an intro. And you saved us. You saved us from that. Tell us, Joe, where did that phenomenal little conversation starter come from?
I was at a meeting this past Wednesday, and a 14-year-old boy named David was coming up with a whole bunch of different conversation starters to try to use to help this club that we're a part of grow for next year. And we were talking about the August meeting, even though I'm not going to be there because I'm repatriating to the States. And so that was one of David's. So I will tell David that his idea started the podcast.
I don't want to be the only one who gives an answer here. I need to know both of your responses. What are you choosing to win this war, this kitchen war?
For David's sake, we do have to answer. Because 14-year-old David is now officially our creative team of writers.
Welcome, David,
and thank you for your hard work. We think you're going to take this podcast to new heights.
Mm-hmm. I've put more thought into this than Chris has. I heard this for the first time on Wednesday, and we have a very long bread knife. That's like, okay. It's like half a meter. This thing is really long.
Wow.
And the good thing about that is if you say the refrigerator, you can use that knife to cut the Freon pipe. If you say the oven, you can actually jam in and like mess up with the coils. If you say the kitchen sink and you're like, you have like a garbage disposal, I can jam the garbage disposal with it. Like that bread knife would be my, and it's the length of a sword. Yep. So for me, it's a bread knife.
Oh, okay. Man. I'm glad I listened to that first. Cause that changes how I was going to answer. Maybe now I'd go with a lighter. I feel like most kitchens have got a lighter in them. I don't know how a lighter would fare against, I probably couldn't, burn that sword, but I could at least make life uncomfortable for that sword. Or I could burn down the entire kitchen so that only that bread knife slash sword remains, and then we would unite in our power and rule over the smoldering husk of a kitchen that we once had. And then we would have to learn the life lesson that sometimes you fight so hard for something, you end up destroying it in the process. Mm-hmm. And the camera pans out on a lighter and a half meter long breadsword presiding over the ashes, the ashes of their disquiet recalcitrance.
Yeah, this is like, this is what makes a great conversation starter, right? But the whole idea of alliances is already, so my thought when you said lighter was you're going to team up with the oven.
Oh,
right. Turn the gas on and burn the whole place down.
Burn
I'm still
down.
The sink. So I'm the only thing who could put out the fire, which makes it worthwhile for you, bread knife, to team up with me, because we have to fight against the fire starters. All of a sudden this has turned into, it's like a world war, but it's a full on like kitchen war one.
It's kitchen wars. Yeah. I see an entire animated series and possibly even a video game.
Yeah, my goodness.
Being launched out of this. 14-year-old David, creative team of writers, is now executive producer to a successful line of animated shorts and a forthcoming video game series. He doesn't even know everything he's accomplished at 14. Whew. David, well done. Well done, buddy. But I do, even the scenario, Jerry, it just created a whole bunch of problems. And you know what, Jerry? Talking about problems, sometimes...
You got to watch me. You got to watch me. And when I'm taking a drink of coffee, you can't go to the segue. All right.
That's why I did it. Actually. I was like, oh, okay. Oh, all right. He's disarmed. I can segue. The cup goes up and so does my pitch, Jerry. So does my pitch.
That's right. Jerry, that's right.
All these problems make me think, what about the solutions in life? And Jerry, that's part of the reason I've brought Joe here. Because Joe happens to be rather a bit of an expert in something called solution focused therapy. He is a solution focused practitioner. And when I heard about this, I got to hang out with Joe a little bit in Bangkok, Thailand at a conference a few months back now. And we got to chat about this and I thought it was fascinating. I thought Jerry must know, both of our listeners must know. So
I'm excited already.
Yeah, it's good stuff. And why don't we, I'm going to let Joe tell us a little bit about yourself. Like I said, you and I got to hang out in Bangkok. You work in international schools. You're about to move. You've got a cross-cultural family. You're a bit of a legend with a lot going on. So give us a little background so that we can get to the solution-focused therapy, which I think is so fascinating.
Ooh, the short version. Okay. This is my 26th year in education. I started off as a teacher, realized I wanted to work in an area where kids were my focus, not the curriculum, and where the kids actually made my curriculum. So I moved into counseling, decided it was time to get busy living or get busy dying, and sold my house, sold my car, moved to Russia.
And,
as mine does. And I was supposed to be there 2 years. I ended up meeting the love of my life December of my first year there, which totally changed my trajectory. So I stayed 12.
And you know what else happened in that time, Joe? Sorry to interrupt. Because not only did you meet your wife, but you met me.
Yes. Chris visited.
That's kind of how we measure all timelines around here, Joe, is
pretty much
when did you meet Chris? That's what really matters. Yeah, love of your life, schmub of your life.
Sure.
Right? When did you meet Chris?
So Chris visited my school to give a presentation around, I would have to guess, 2015.
That sounds about right.
And then 2019, my family decided time to try something different. So we moved to Israel. And
as you do.
Yeah. And we've been here 4 years now. And we decided that it was time to give our kids a taste of U.S. life. So because they've never lived there. So we're moving to Fairfax County, Virginia, in a city called Falls Church. And we'll be leaving in, 3 weeks.
Wow.
It's happening. We've caught him in the cusp of transition.
Yes. Oh, but I didn't mention the whole solution focus thing. Halfway through, about 8 years into my counseling experience, I was big in this thing called choice theory, which is a problem-focused approach that's relationship-based. And if you ever heard of Glasser, I'm kind of a theory dork. I could talk about this all the time. But there's a guy named William Glasser that this was his bread and butter going back to the 60s. And it helps me help people, but it also left me kind of fried. Just rolling around in people's muck all day long. I would go home and I would be like, I just can't listen anymore sometimes. Right. And, and I was thinking, okay, what else is there out there? So I started thinking about other stuff. And at the same time, I encountered a friend who was big in solution-focused counseling. She was attending this program from an organization called Brief in the UK that trained in solution-focused brief therapy. And I said, I need to find out more about this. And I fell in love with it. Got trained through another organization as well. Got certified in both just because I really wanted to become well-versed in the solution-focused approach because they're different branches of the tree. And I wanted to understand what why some of the branches didn't like one another. And but the overall principles all fall back to the beliefs of Steve DeShazer and his wife, Insu Kimberg, who in the late 70s and early 80s came up with solution-focused brief therapy. And its major premise is that problem talk creates problems, solution talk creates solutions. And if you want to help people move past the problem, you have to help them build what they actually want rather than focus on what they don't want. So you help them think about, you know, what's wanted, what works, and what's next to create a path forward. And I working in schools, most training programs are geared towards therapists. And with my understanding of the different approaches, and I came up with a streamlined version for schools that gets to the heart of the matter in an approach that can be done in 10 to 30 minutes as compared to the standard 40 to 60.
Yeah. Wow.
While still focusing on the good stuff. So you build on people's strengths to help them get what they want.
Yeah. Wow. So I'm the first question for me that jumps out is, like, what's the distinction here? What makes this therapy versus like coaching?
This is a whole philosophical argument, even amongst practitioners, because, and it also varies country to country and region to region. So like some people say it's all the same crap. Other people say, oh, that's sacrilege. And they'll go into splitting hairs.
Sure. So what's the party line? What, like, how do you feel? Like, you're a counselor, you're a therapist, right? What makes you a therapist in solution focused therapy?
Basically, that's two different questions. Okay.
See, only a therapist would say that. So, right?
Basically, if you talk to people who are getting paid by insurance companies, have a different answer than people who aren't. Okay.
Which is true of everything. Right?
Yeah. So
like every, yeah. Sure.
Basically, if you have to tie things to the DSM-5 in order to make money, you would say, well, therapy really helps people overcome trauma and issues to have a brighter future. Mm-hmm. But then you have to be able to identify what is the problem so you can write it off on the insurance box and to be able to charge. People who don't need to worry about that look at it as, you know, in the overall scheme of things, you want to help people have build the future they desire. And I don't really care what you call it. So I've been trained by two different organizations that actually have different definitions for therapy versus coaching. So So I look at it as, rather than create an argument for your 3 to 100, 3,000 right. listeners that might be partaking in yeah. this conversation, yeah. okay. I'll just say is, I look at it as, it doesn't matter if you call it solution-focused counseling, solution-focused brief counseling, solution-focused therapy, solution-focused brief therapy. If you're a solution-focused practitioner, you help people look at what's wanted now, and after they have that
how
thing,
do I get there? Yeah.
Look at what's working, and then build what's next to connect the dots.
Yeah, love that. Love that. It's brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah. So, Chris, where do you want to go? Let's fix Chris. Like, what do you want?
Is there really enough time? Is there enough time for that in this episode, Jerry? Is there? Well, no, I think what fascinated me about this is that it seems to be a completely different approach to almost everything I've heard lately, because I think a lot of what we're into right now, and maybe not even just right now, but for a while, has very much been, well, let's get to the root of the problems. The starting point is usually, well, let's figure out what's wrong. And mm-hmm. then, you know, we can start moving toward this. And so it's become, I think, really, really popular to delve into, you know, what are your childhood issues? What are the wounds mm-hmm. that are deep in there? What are their, you know what I mean? That's very much a focus and it's so much so that I think it's nearly an assumed position that you have mm-hmm. to start with the bad before you can possibly move on to something good. This seems so different.
It is. And there are two hooks to start off a conversation if you're coming in to have a conversation with somebody for the first time. And one is, as they're walking in the door, you don't say, how are you? Because how are you? If they're coming to see somebody about a problem, they're thinking that's the invitation to start complaining.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yep.
So conversely, you say, what are your best hopes for talking today?
Mm.
And then they get to why they actually came to see you.
They just switch, yeah.
And if they get to why they came to see you, you focus on, you can then channel it to what difference would it make if we did that? And then they tell you, and then you can narrow down to, okay, so if we helped you get X, would that be a good use of our time?
Yeah.
Yes, and then you seal a contract, and then you jump for, okay, and move forward. And the other one is if you don't really know them that well, you say, you know, before we get started, do you mind if I ask you a couple of questions? And then they'll say, sure. You're like, what are you good at or proud of? And like, what? Mm-hmm. And then you start, and you help them start talking about strengths and successes, and you use that information later in the conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's brilliant. So another question. In your understanding and in your positioning, because I'm imagining there, like, you've seen all the conversations, everybody, and you even see, like, there's branches of the same tree that debate this, right? Like that have differing positions and opinions. But in your assessment and kind of where you are, does this work always, or are there situations where you would say maybe you actually need to spend a little time in your past or with your I'm thinking of traumatic situations, or like, is this valuable for traumatic situations?
Trauma. Yeah. It's statistically valid to be able to use in, like, you could say, what about X? What about Y? I rather than say which ones it is best for, I look at it as, if you're helping the person create what they want, mm-hmm. it's working. So the challenge they come in with, it's beneficial if you understand that challenge, but you don't have to roll around in that challenge. Like, say, for example, like some people would say, like one example, if somebody is battling suicidal ideation, okay, if you need to do an on the ground assessment at that moment to make sure they're not going to like do something drastic in your office or as soon as they leave, that's a different type of questioning than if you're helping them build that successful, happy life they want. Right, so yeah. It depends. Yeah. So it really depends on the challenge that's in front of you. And this is not a diagnostic tool. It's a path to help people create what they want.
Yeah.
So yes, you do have to take a step back and say, well, for this situation, maybe you should do this. But this approach does work to help alleviate suicidal ideation. Yeah. It just can't be used to diagnose whether somebody is suicidal.
Yeah. Okay. I get it. So it's not necessarily even an either or, like which type of therapy might be helpful here. This like solution focused is always potentially helpful. Like there's always a path where this could be the thing that's needed here. And there may be other things to consider as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, like they could walk in tandem. And that makes sense to me.
Most therapies, like cognitive behavioral people will disagree with the statement because they dominate the U.S. market right now. But
sure.
Most therapies are really predicated upon the relationship and validating how the person is feeling. And then you help them move forward. Correspondingly. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I could do a quick little search and say which one is best for this and which one is best for that. And there are many different things that are all perfectly, wonderfully valid. Mm-hmm. This is just the one that helps make me happy and also prove successful for the people I work with.
Yep. Love it.
Well, and I think, you know, the one way to look at this, and I like what you've already said about the fact that, you know, Jerry, you brought up it's not necessarily either or. You know, I think that the idea behind it is less, if I'm hearing you right, the idea behind it is less just sort of a cherry picking. Well, let's ignore the problem and just move right on to the positive bits, because that sounds like it, you know, sounds great. But I think the reality is, you know, I think everyone would agree, problems are there, they have to be dealt with. And this is less a ignore the problem and more a let's change the angle at which we come with it. And what it made me think of was, I remember hearing once, I don't know if this holds true, if either of our listeners have been to or work at Disney, they can tell me. But I remember reading once that Disney employees or cast members, as they're called, are trained to answer everything in the affirmative. So, for example, if you were to ask someone at Disney, if you were to ask someone working at a park, be like, hey, what time does the park close? They're supposed to not answer in the negative. They're supposed to answer in the positive. And instead of saying, the park closes at 9, they're supposed to say the park is open until 9 o'clock. And so it's that whole idea of it is still giving you, you know, the information. You're still getting to the destination you want. But you're switching the lens and the framework through which you get there. So you're still getting the park does close at 9, but another way of looking at that is the park is open until 9. And, and that's kind of how I read this, that it's not that it's avoiding, the difficulty of problems, because let me tell you, as both of you may know, and as both of our listeners may know, I am a conflict avoidant person. So, you know, you had me at solution focused. I was like, oh, that sounds way less conflicty. Fantastic. But I think, you know, the reality is that the some of the beauty of this is maybe that it's not avoiding, you know, the conflict. It's not avoiding, you know, the difficulty of the problems, but it's coming at it in an approach. It's coming at it in a way where the solution is actually the focus. So you're still getting all the nutrients that you need. You're just reframing it. And man, nowadays reframing just seems like such a really important thing.
To me, it sounds like, and I'd be curious your experience on this. But people are people, right? And people are oftentimes hardwired to really kind of, even there's like, I think there's dopamine connected to wallowing in our problems, right? And so when somebody gives us attention on our problems, when we complain about our problems and you give me attention, that's what I want. That's honestly what I want. And I think a lot of people approach therapy like that as an experience. Like, this is the joy I'm going to get out of this is wallowing in my problems. And this is like a refocusing. Do you get resistance from people who really just came? They didn't really come. They didn't want a solution, right? They honestly, they may think they do. And if you ask them, of course, they would say yes. But the reality is,
I just want to gripe a little bit, or like legitimately, I want to unpack my hurt and my pain because that feels good. Do you get resistance from people who maybe want that instead of solution focus?
Yeah, actually, the one of the benefits of being in schools is that one of the benefits was starting with what are your best hopes for talking today? People come to see me about 50 different things. And mm-hmm. like sometimes they just want information. They want me to be a consultant. They just need to know, what do I do about this? And they don't want, it's not about a situation. Answer, it's like, right? Who do I talk to? What's the number? Whatever. Mm-hmm. So this just kind of expedites the things. But when some people just say, I just want to vent. Yeah. And then say, okay, well, what difference would it make if you were able to vent right now? Well, I would just get it out. Mm-hmm. And usually I'll say, okay, well, how would that be different? And they'll say, well, it'll make me feel better. And say, okay, well, if we could come up with a way that would make you feel better at the end of our conversation, would that be a good mm-hmm. use of our time? Well, sure. And then you can actually focus on what makes them feel better rather than the venting. But you do need to validate. Like Chris was saying, like it's not necessarily a repackaging, but you can't push people immediately. You have to validate what the pain they're feeling, but then also find the strengths within it. Yeah. So you look at it with solution focused looking, which is the reframing mm-hmm. of looking at, like, if someone is really bossy. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. If you see a bossy person, that means it's a person that has strong conviction who is willing to fight for what they want. Mm-hmm. And you talk to that person differently than somebody who you think is bossy, even mm-hmm. though it's the same mm-hmm. thing. So that is the reframing. But then you have to use solution-focused looking to see, like, what are their strengths? What is it that they really want, and what can you do with that? So mm-hmm. if they're going through a lot of stuff, you can say, wow, that's tough. How'd you do it? And then they tell you about how they got through it. And then you find the strengths to build forward from.
Yeah, that's genius. I like that.
I think one of the things this made me think about was even this approach, the reframing, even the example you just gave, the idea of, okay, so what do you do if you deal with a bossy person? I think some of the beauty of this is that it's very empowering because it kind of pushes back onto you that it's not just this bossy person, it's your reaction to this bossy person. So if you reframe them from being bossy to being, wow, strong conviction, you're right, you treat them differently. And I think... Yeah. I think there's a lot about that. I think one of the things that, like I said, really drew me to it was the idea that it's empowering, the idea that you're not just a victim in all circumstances. And that's not to say that there aren't situations where people are victims. There absolutely are. But that instead of making the assumption that, you know, oh, I'm having to deal with this controlling person or this bossy person or this fill in the blank, whatever it is that bugs you about someone, that instead of just saying, you know, they are bossy and I'm a victim of their bossiness, I can't get things done because they mm-hmm. just keep bossing me around, they never listen to my opinions or what have you, that this reframing actually is very empowering because it says, okay, but what can you do with that? And it made me think of, I can remember reading about, and of course, I can't remember the author or the book. So, you know, that great author mm-hmm. talked about how
I remember that one.
Is mm-hmm. such insightful work in his compendium.
And with the pages.
There was words on them. It was great. Mm-hmm. Talked about how we sort of naturally fit into roles. And one of the things he pointed out was, he's like, you know, a lot of times, maybe as parents or as teachers working with kids, we think, man, they're so unruly and out of control. You know, because they're so out of control, I have to be such an enforcer. And that sometimes we forget it's the flip side, that we mm-hmm. we make assumptions and we come in. Basically, his point was, if you act like a policeman, you're encouraging someone to act like a criminal. You know, if you whatever role you take on, you actually influence someone to move into a complementary role, And this seems to tie into that, that actually, you know, if someone is bossy, if you take the role of someone being bossed around, you actually have some power. Like you're kind of empowering bossiness by acting like someone who's being bossed around.
Chris, you inadvertently just hit one of the other major tenets of solution focused therapy.
And look at that.
No, like you're spot on. You're following the same path that Stephen and Sue did, in that they refused to take on the expert role, because they look at it as everybody is able to find their own solutions with guidance. They are the expert in their lives. We are just curious bystanders that help them create what they want. And so that's like a lot of therapy is the therapist, their job is to analyze and dole out different things that will help work and teach the people how to use them. Whereas in solution-focused practice, you help the people identify their strengths and build upon those to get what's wanted. So we're just curious bystanders that ask questions, as compared to experts that dole out assignments.
Right. Yep.
So Chris and Stephen and Sue would love you if they were still alive.
Oh, that's good to hear. That's good to hear.
But that you just invented solution-focused therapy. Well done, Chris. A little late, but
I know. I'm a little amazing. Bit behind the times. Just a
if,
little
if
bit.
We had a nickel for everything we invented that somebody else invented before us.
Seriously.
Oh, man. So would you use this type of therapy in a group setting?
Oh, totally. Yeah, you can use it with groups. You can use it with classes. You can use it you can use it in staff meetings. You can use it in it depends on there are minor variations, of course. You'd have slight twists and turns, but the general premise that the people are the best resources, that they all have strengths and they all want something. Mm-hmm. So if you can get a unified thing that's desired, find out what's working, you can then connect the dots to build what's next.
Yeah. Mm. Yep. That's great. Can you give us, I know confidentiality is certainly a thing, but can you give us your favorite success story, an example of a time this worked and you were just really proud, happy?
You can change the names to Chris and Jerry if it makes you feel
Chris
better.
Chris and Jerry, yeah, or Diesel and Clooney.
Yeah. Either way. Change the names to protect the innocent.
Well, one that was fairly recent that just sticks in my head. I had a kid who was going through some stuff and she was battling with her parents. And I said, well, you know, the best way to really work on this might be to take a team approach. And she said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, maybe we should involve your parents. And she actually gave in. And the thing is with in schools, at least in Western schools and international schools, generally if you're dealing with secondary students, you don't really involve parents unless the kid is a danger to herself or others, okay? Unless it's desired. And since I thought it would be the best help for her, I just pitched it and I didn't even need to sell it. I just gave her like the pitch and she was
the
just,
option, yeah.
Yeah. And she was just like, yeah, maybe we should. So I called them. We ended up having two different family meetings spread out about 3.5-4 weeks. And the dad gave me a really, he gave me a really big compliment. He said, you know, I'm never going to forget you because you made a difference for my family.
Wow. Wow.
That's and awesome. That's about the biggest compliment.
Which is why you
anybody
do this,
can,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like why you do this work. Yeah. Yeah. Those are those moments that like those reminder moments of, wow, what I do is valuable. What I do actually works. And good for the people that I get to be a part of helping.
Well, and the funny thing is in education in general, you have to take for granted you're doing good and doing well. Okay. And you almost never get positive feedback and you don't look for it. You don't expect it. And when you get it, it feels good just because you don't look for it and you just have to take for granted most of the time that it is working.
Yep.
So just nice to hear it sometimes.
Absolutely.
It is nice to hear it sometimes. So Joe George, and again, such a good name. I always want to use your first name and surname. What if you were to give sort of a very concise, almost like a little starter pack? If either our listeners were saying to themselves, "Man, I could do with some of this," because I think it's the kind of thing where in the same vein of nobody's an expert, we're all curious observers. I think it's the sort of thing that could be deployed for ourselves. You know, I listen to this and I think, okay, I can do a checklist and think, what are the parts in my life where consciously or unconsciously I'm taking a passive role. I'm acting more like a victim. I'm acting more like, well, this person acts this way, and as a result, my life is more difficult, you know, and this kind of approach makes me check that and think, okay, is it possible for me to reframe it and take a more active role? What could I do there? So I think it's the kind of thing you can use for yourself, but even the kind of thing, in some ways, it's almost empowering to make everybody a curious observer in everybody else's life. That in some ways we're actually building a network to help each other in this. If I'm, you know, if I take this to a very positive place, and I will. So with that, you know, is there a sort of a brief step-by-step, and I know there's so much to this, and we'll definitely, you know, put your information on the page, because I'm hoping people will, you know, have more questions and want to know about where more resources are. But just in a very quick sense, is there a quick step-by-step guide that people could use, or maybe a quick list to go, okay, this, I want to be solution focused. Here's how I start that. And here's a very top level way of doing that.
Well, for a cheat sheet starter kit, the first step would be omit the word why from your lexicon.
Ooh. Yes.
Okay. How and what generally draw out exactly what you want without the person feeling attacked? Oh. Why, by definition, in any culture, in any language I've ever partaken in, why is probing and analyzing, and generally causes a defensive response in a lot of people.
Oh, okay. That's so interesting.
So I would say, like, for me, I don't ask why. Like, if they do something, I used to be the king of why. I wanted to know why. And I needed to battle that. And I just because why almost never matters.
That goes against all of my intuition. It does. Mm-hmm. It goes against all of my intuition.
Sure. I want to know why. I had to battle that and overcome that in myself before I was able to regularly succeed using this. And because I wanted to analyze. And you have to get past that and to help literally just look and listen for what they want and help build it.
Yeah.
Oh, in terms of trainings and stuff, there are a bunch of different good organizations out there. I even have a training, but it's rather than focusing on the questions, you like a lot of the trainings actually do focus on different types of questions you ask in different situations. I think that makes you solution forced. That doesn't make you solution focused. And if you treat everything like a nail, you're going to hit everything you encounter with a hammer. But if you're a curious bystander and you just want to help them look at, you know, what's wanted, what works, and what's next, you can be, if you look at solution-focused listening, which is, again, is the reframing, and solution-focused looking, which is the reframing, and solution-focused listening, which is helping them find the strengths while getting out of your own way. If you, because like I personally have to start with putting out my halo, which I know that's cheesy. It's my cheesy acronym, and it's
we love acronyms.
I have to walk in and say, "Okay, Joe," talking to myself. "Okay, how are you?" And then I have to assess, how am I? And if I'm amped up, I have to take a breath or do whatever I do to help me calm down for that moment and get out of my own way. Then ask myself, am I ready to look and listen? Okay, go. So, and I even have a bracelet that I regularly wear with a little yellow band on it. And that's when I see it, that's just, I try to look at that before I walk into meetings, because I'm a pacifist with a bad temper, man. And if people are, if people are coming in, if people come out swinging, I'm a fighter. And so, but if I prepare myself before I walk in, knowing that someone's going to take a swing at me as soon as I walk in, I can just kind of block it and then calmly ask what I can roll with the punches without throwing. And too many fight analogies. I'm sorry, but it's
it was good.
So I have to get out of my own way regularly. So I, and that only happened. Like, so that's the reason why this is a lot easier to do professionally than it is emotionally with your family. The hardest part for me to regularly utilize this is with my family. And because the people, when you come home, your guard's down and you just, you're just tired and you just had a long trip or you just had a long flight and a crappy cab driver or whatever. And then you walk in and the, if someone starts at you, it's hard to say, what are your best hopes for this conversation?
Yeah, it's way easier to say, why are you doing this to me?
So, so I regularly have to get out of my own way. And when I start with Halo, I can use solution-focused looking and solution-focused listening in any environment, including with family. But I need to remind myself first. So if you can do those three things while omitting why, those are your starting points.
That's it. Yeah. Wow. Wow. That's outstanding. I like that why piece. I think especially in that cross-cultural context, like people who are doing this across lines of difference, right? Like that's the first question that we want to ask. Why? Why, like, why do these people do this this way, right?
Yeah.
But as you frame it, like, and this is something, I've talked a lot about that in my cross-cultural experience, is taking out that question, why? But the reason is because, like, if I was to come to Israel today, I've never been there. Everything would be new. I would want to know why for everything. You're the person that I know, right? So you're the person that I talk to. So I would say, hey, Joe George, why? Why do they act this way? Why does this food taste this way? Why? And you would give me an answer, right? Like you'd say, oh, that's because, but that's based on your 5 years of experience. And is it 5 years in Israel?
Four years
in Israel as an expat, as a foreigner, somebody. And so your why is not going to be the same as if I go talk to somebody else, right?
Totally.
But even if I go talk to somebody who grew up there and lived there, I'll get their version of why. And you may have some insight, some nugget of information and understanding that they wouldn't have because you came in with a fresh perspective, with an outsider. So it's like both of those answers are a part of the answer to why, but neither of them is the full answer to why. But because you're my friend, because I go in and talk to you and I say why, and you give me the answer, I walk away and say, now I understand why, right? Like now I have the full understanding of why, because Joe George told me, right? And he's been here 4 years longer than I have. And so then I move forward thinking that I've got an understanding of why, and I become dangerous, right? I will then pass that on to, because
it's the human telephone, honestly, game.
Yeah, exactly. Like your version of why is 4 years better than mine, but now I think I understand that and I translate it and then I go pass it on to somebody else. And that's where things get really, really messy in the cross-cultural space, in the expat world, in this international thing that we love so much. But asking why creates a lot of people who think they have some understanding that they just don't yet. Right?
Without going too much into it, it's also, this is very good with multiple cultures, because it doesn't put your own preconceived notions on that culture with the person you're supporting. So you're creating the meaning they want rather than analyzing and acting accordingly. Yeah, so because you remove the why.
Yeah. Yep. So good.
Man, and deep down, I think the reality is, because I can't help but be resistant because I love why. But I really do. The motivation behind things is important and fascinating to me. But if I step back, you know, and try to be objective about it, the reality is, I don't think we even really know some of our own whys sometimes. You know, like why is probably a pretty unreliable peg on which to place, on which to place everything else. Because why changes, and we do. I think we're masters at self deception. You know, I can think of loads of instances where if you asked me why I did something, I would knee jerk tell you a response that if I dug a little bit, probably wasn't even accurate. You know, why is queuing so important? And I would say, well, because it's orderly and it keeps things fair for everybody. But if it's I really dig below
British answer.
It is. I know. It's very revealing that I went right to queuing. Right to queuing.
Right.
In fact, just to fit, so it, well, I'm going to do this entire segment in an English accent because
it fits. He's here.
It fits so much better. But it is, for me, queuing, so very important. And so if you ask me, you know, why is queuing so important? And I would say, well, because it's orderly, because it's fair, and because, you know, my why is that I believe in justice. But if I dig a bit deeper, it's usually because those moments where I would say that is the real why is, well, because I got up early to be here. So I'm owed a better place in the queue because I invested. I woke up and you people clearly didn't. So you don't get to jump in front of me. I invested my time here. And that's actually a very different why. It's very, very different to say why I believe in queuing because it's fair. And digging a little deeper and saying, why do I believe in queuing? Because I'm owed it, because I invested in it, because it's fair to me. So I do. I think the why itself might be too shifty to peg too much on, because it changes for people and it changes over time. It's like I said, as resistant as I am, it makes sense.
And if you ask that question across cultures, right, another culture is going to say, well, queuing is important because the rules say you have to queue. And if you don't, you get in trouble, right? Like that's why it's important. And if you ask another culture, why is queuing important? They're like, it's not. It's stupid. It's a terrible system. And why would you ever do that, right? Yeah. Because everybody has a different understanding of how they do it, of what queuing is, right? But that idea of why this is important, and we've never thought about it before. I would just do it, right? Like this is what you do. But there are cultures where you don't queue, and
when the queuers try to
get to the front with the queuers, that's where it gets really, really, really messy.
Yeah. Oh, it is where I want to burn down the whole kitchen. Just burn the whole kitchen down.
Yep. Yep. I have. Like I played basketball when I was younger, so I'm educated. I'm schooled in how to box out. What you say? Make your body big, get your elbows up, put the elbow in the chest of the people around you. But I mean, the amount of time I spent in Asia, right? Like there are parts where queuing is not a thing. You just push to the front, and I've boxed out some tiny little old ladies, right? Who were just I saw them.
The only way to survive. It's the only way to survive.
Yep. Make yourself big. Stick the elbow. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and this is when how becomes useful. Because rather than looking at a whole mass of people cutting you off and saying, why? You look and say, how do I do this? And then you're actually finding the solution.
Right. Right.
Right.
Oh, my that's where the solution is. This is so good. This is. Chris, you have amazing people in your life. Thank you for bringing yet another one to open our eyes and expand our lives. Yeah,
I'm a very fortunate boy. That's really my job, Jerry. I just fly around the
just
world.
Just go find great people and bring them here. Yep, you're doing great.
Seek them out. Joe George, it really has been such a good conversation, and I knew it would be. Is there, and we'll make sure and put this in the show notes on the page and everything as well, but how can people get in touch with you? What's the best way to contact you through website or what have you?
Through either my questions? Website or my email. My website is solutionfocusedfuture.com, and with no hyphens or anything, just solutionfocusedfuture.com, or my email is joegeorge.sff@gmail.com. And that's Joe George, all one word. It's joegeorge.sff, as in Solution Focused Future, at gmail.com.
Excellent. Perfect. Well, we will. Like I said, we'll put that on the show notes as well. But I wanted to make sure people, because there's so much more to this. I mean, we've just scratched the surface. So if people did want to delve deeper, they should be able to get in contact with you that way. But I mean, I feel like, you know, every now and then Jerry and I think that we've solved all the problems. Every now and then we think, well, we've unpacked and we've unpacked a lot of things. But Joe George, I do think we've unpacked and solved everything. We've solved why, and we don't even need to know why. We just need to know the how we did it, and how we did it was we got to chat with you. So that's probably the worst missed application of all the genius things you've said. Just gonna wrap it up with a terrible example of what not to do. sometimes that's our position in life. Jerry and I, we've taken on that mantle. Sometimes.
So what's the moral of the story? If you don't know, ask Joe.
Don't know.
That's it. Ask Joe George.
Man, look at everything that has spawned out of this one episode. We've got an animated Kitchen War series. We've got a video game Kitchen War series. Again, thanks to David, our 14-year-old team of writers. But if you don't know, ask Joe. I think that needs to be trending.
That's our new t-shirt.
T-shirt. Yeah, there we go. We came up with this week's merch. Oh, perfect. Joe, thank you so much. Sorry, Joe George, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a delight and a pleasure. And I think we'll have to have you back again.
Yeah, because... pleasure would be all mine. Ask away. And I'll be in a better time zone soon. So
this is very true. But will we be is the problem.
Changes every week, so
it does. Time zone. You can't ask why. You just have to ask how am I going to get up early enough to coordinate with these other time zones. That's the how. Oh, good times, dear listeners. Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to seeing you again soon for more solutions in the future.